This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Dualism is obviously a central concept in Buddhism, but it's typically framed as a simple opposition, self and other, self and thing, self and world, with the alternative being non-separation, or a becoming one with the thing or from which one had been separated. Even though we may get a lot of sophisticated interplay described in something like the Sandokai, basically the problem is separation and the solution is non-separation. With non-separation, or unity being a kind of underlying truth from which separation is our ordinary delusional misconstrual of reality. What we saw when we read Buber's I and Thou was an alternative to that schema of, and the problem of dualism, where the alternative to I-it dualism wasn't merger or non-separation with the thing, but a different kind of relationship, an I-thou relationship. And that, as Buber said, the I of the I-thou is different than the I of the I-it. We become more fully who we are in relation, not in unity, not in non-separation, but in relation. That idea is going to be developed in much more complexity and depth in Bonds of Love. And the framing of dualism is going to also become much more complex. And she's going to go into lots of the ways in which separation manifests as different kinds of binaries, typically characterized by a certain form of domination of one side or the other. And if we don't think that domination is the kind of thing we usually see as a problem in Buddhism or our meditation practice, I would say that we should recognize the way we all come to practice with a certain kind of curative fantasy in which one part of our mind that we think of as good comes to dominate the bad. And the bad is often characterized by thought or emotion or desire or attachment. But that the overcoming of one part by another is something that's very fundamental to how many people's practices are organized. Consciously or unconsciously. One part goes against, to war against the other and calls it spirituality. Now I'm going to try to read the introduction here and make some comments as I go along. Book opens with a epigraph from Freud's Civilization and Its Discontents. Men are not gentle creatures. You all right there? Men are not gentle creatures who want to be loved and who at the most can defend themselves if they are attacked. They are, on the contrary, creatures among whose instinctual endowments is to be reckoned a powerful share of aggressiveness. As a result, their neighbor is for them not only a potential helper or sexual object, but someone who tempts them to satisfy their aggressiveness on it, to exploit his capacity for work without compensation, to use him sexually without his consent, to seize his possessions, to humiliate him, to cause him pain, to torture, and to kill him. Homo homini lupus, man is wolf to man. Who in the face of all his experience of life and of history will have the courage to dispute this assertion? And Freud is making here a basic case, not just about the inevitability of war between individuals, but the inevitability of an internal struggle. The struggle between the rational and the irrational, between reason and aggression, between something, one part of us needing to dominate the other in order for civilization to be possible. Now this will be Jessica's beginning of the introduction. Since Thomas Hobbes, in his Justification of Authority, first analyzed the passions, domination has been understood as a psychological problem. Echoing Hobbes's view of the state of nature, Freud locates the origin of the problem in our lupine, wolf-like proclivities. The injunction to love our neighbor is not a reflection of abiding concern for others, but a testimony to the opposite, a propensity for aggression. While Freud acknowledges the strictures of culture are painful, he also believes they protect us from the dangers of nature. Or put another way, the rule of authority is preferable to the war of all against all. An unflinching scrutiny of human destructiveness convinces him that the repression demanded by civilization is preferable to the ruthlessness that prevails in the state of nature. But Freud's vision of the conflict between instinct and civilization, each with its own dangers and drawbacks, has actually created an impasse for social thought. In framing the problem of domination in such terms, Freud left no exit. Either we accept the necessity of rational authority to control our dangerous nature, or we maintain naively that our better nature is dangerously repressed by the social order. But this opposition between instinct and civilization obscures the central question of how domination actually works. As Foucault puts it, if power were never anything but repressive, if it never did anything but to say no, do you really think one would be brought to obey it? The concept of repression cannot grasp that power holds good, not by denying our desire, but by forming it, by converting it into a willing retainer, its servant or representative. It cannot grasp domination as a system that transforms all parts of the psyche. Only when we realize that power is not simply prohibition can we step outside the framework of choosing between repressive authority and unbridled nature. This book is an analysis of the interplay between love and domination. It conceives domination as a two-way process, a system involving the participation of those who submit to power, as well as those who exercise it. Above all, this book seeks to understand how domination is anchored in the hearts of the dominated. This is not a new question. Dostoevsky's classic discussion of authority, The Grand Inquisitor, dramatized the psychological force of domination. In it, Christ returns to earth during the Inquisition and confronts the Inquisitor with the Church's debasement of faith. Why has a free act of love been transformed into a practice of submission? The Inquisitor responds that people do not want freedom and truth, which only cause deprivation and suffering. They want miracle, mystery, and authority. The pain that accompanies compliance is preferable to the pain that attends freedom. The awesome nearness of the ultimate power embodied in the Church makes pain tolerable, even a source of inspiration or transcendence. This ability to enlist the hope for redemption is the signature of the power that inspires voluntary submission. We recognize it in a wide range of social phenomena, whether Pope or political party, as the power that inspires fear and adoration simultaneously. Freud offered the most far-reaching perspective on the working of domination. In accord with his view of the state of nature, Freud imagined the origins of civilization in the primal struggle between father and son. The sons who overthrow the father's authority become afraid of their own aggression and lawlessness and regret the loss of his wonderful power. So they reinstate law and authority in the father's image. Thus, in a seemingly unbreakable circle, revolt is always followed by guilt and the restoration of authority. As Herbert Marcuse noted, in every revolution, the hope of abolishing domination has been defeated by the establishment of a new authority. Every revolution has also been a betrayed revolution. The psychoanalytic inquiry into domination has been reformulated a number of times since Freud, but always in the primary metaphor of the father-son struggle. Some psychoanalytic critics concluded paternal authority wasn't so bad after all, because the sons inherit the benefits as well as the limits of the law. Others countered the concession to authority, arguing the lifting of repression could potentially dissolve destructiveness of the instinct. But their opposition to paternal law was based on an embrace of nature that evaded the problem of human destructiveness. It seemed indeed to fly in the face of all we know of life and history. The historic problem that shaped the inquiry into domination most powerfully, of course, was the appearance of fascist mass movements with their ecstatic submission to the hypnotic leader. Some psychoanalytic social critics argued it was the failure of rational paternal authority, a fatherless society, that stimulated the yearnings for surrender to a powerful leader. Thus, the paradigm, the struggle between father and son, framed the understanding of domination as a choice between rational, democratic, and irrational authority, essentially a choice of the lesser evil. Now we'll hear something of the turn that Jessica and her generation brought to this problem. What's extraordinary about the discussion of authority throughout Freudian thought is that it occurs exclusively in the world of men. The struggle for power takes place between father and son. Woman plays no part in it, except as prize or temptation to regression, or as a third point in a triangle. There is no struggle between man and woman in this story. Indeed, woman's subordination to man is taken for granted, invisible. Even the most radical of Freudians left strangely untouched psychoanalyst's most profound and unexamined assumption about domination, the subordination of women to men. The point of departure for the re-examination of the problem is Simone de Beauvoir's insight that woman functions as man's primary other, his opposite, playing nature to his reason, immanence to his transcendence, primordial oneness to his individuated separateness, and object to his subject. This analysis of gender domination as a complementarity of subject and object, each a mirror image of the others, offers a fresh perspective on the dualism that permeates Western culture and adds, I think, a whole dimension to the understanding of dualism that we receive from Buddhism. It shows how gender polarity underlies such familiar dualism as autonomy and dependency, and thus establishes the coordinates for the positions of master and slave. So rather than focus on the struggle of fathers and sons, Jessica says, I will show how the structure of domination can be traced from the relationship between mother and infant into adult eroticism, from the earliest differences between mother and father to the global images of male and female in a culture. We will begin with the conflict between dependence and independence in infant life, and move outward towards the opposition of power and surrender in adult sexual life. We will see how masculinity and femininity become associated with the posture of master and slave, how these postures arise in boys' and girls' different relationships to mother and father, and how they shape the different destinies of male and female children. To challenge previous psychoanalytic thinking is not, as some feminists believe, merely a matter of arguing that the sexual stereotypes or biases in Freudian thought are socially constructed, nor is it a matter of challenging Freud's view of human nature by arguing that women, unlike men, are gentle creatures. In adopting the feminist critique of gender polarity, I am aware that it is sometimes tended to reinforce the dualism it criticizes. Every binary split creates a temptation to merely reverse its terms. That, I think, is one of her fundamental conclusions. Every binary split creates a temptation to merely reverse its terms, to elevate what has been devalued and denigrate what has been overvalued. To avoid the tendency towards reversal is not easy, especially given the existing division in which the female is culturally defined as that is which is not male. In order to challenge the sexual split which permeates our psychic, cultural, and social life, it's necessary to criticize not only the idealization of the masculine side, but also the reactive valorization of femininity. It's necessary not to take sides, but to remain focused on the dualistic structure itself. The stakes of this enterprise are high. A sharper perspective on this matter is particularly important to feminist thought today, because a major tendency in feminism has constructed the problem of domination as a drama of female vulnerability victimized by male aggression. Even the more sophisticated feminist thinkers frequently shy away from the analysis of submission for fear that in admitting women's participation in the relationship of domination, the onus of responsibility will appear to shift from men to women, the moral victory from women to men. More generally, this has been a weakness of radical politics, to idealize the oppressed as if their politics and culture were untouched by the system of domination, as if people did not participate in their own submission. To reduce domination to a simple relation of do or done to is to substitute moral outrage for analysis. Such a simplification, moreover, reproduces the structure of gender polarity under the guise of attacking it. In this book, I have tried to build on and reframe psychoanalytic theory in order to retell Freud's theory of domination in a way that preserves its complexity and ambiguity. It was Freud's conclusion we could not do without authority, internalized as guilt, and we could not but suffer under its constraint. No doubt our historical situation readily allows us to question the masculine forms of authority, as Freud did not. But this in itself does not immediately resolve the problem of destructiveness or submission. It only starts us on a new approach to grasping the tension between the desire to be free and the desire not to be. To persevere in that approach, it seems to me, requires a theory of some of that quality which Keats demanded for poetry, negative capability. The theoretic equivalent of that ability to face mystery and uncertainty without, in Keats's words, any irritable reaching after fact and reason, would be an effort to understand the contradictions of fact and reason without any irritable reaching after one side at the expense of the other. As I have said elsewhere, a theory or politics that cannot cope with contradiction, that denies the irrational, that tries to sanitize the erotic, fantastic components of human life, cannot visualize an authentic end to domination, but only vacate the field. All right, I hope that will set the stage for our being able to read through this book, not obviously line by line, but in the coming chapters, I will try to offer selective passages for our discussion and our reading. But the theme here, I hope, has become apparent, that the dualism that is domination can't be addressed just by either assuming it's necessary and inevitable, or by reversing the terms, where instead of pessimistically concluding that reason must dominate the instincts, we flip the paradigm and say ecstatically that the instincts will now dominate reason. That was much of what happened to the discussion when we were coming of age in the 60s. And so we want to find an alternative to that kind of either or. And that is that's going to take the shape of what she will call intersubjectivity and require mutual recognition rather than the domination of one side by another. So this is the beginning of our journey, and I hope if we're lucky we'll get Jessica in here to talk about it and answer questions herself, but no promises. She's a tough customer that way. I'll do my best to stand in for her and lead a discussion starting today. Thank you.